I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
The New York Times editorializes today that former counterterrorism adviser Richard Clark has said the words that needed to be said about 9/11. I apologize. When Clark testified yesterday that he failed the families of victims and the government did as well, he became the first American official to utter the phrase. Clark also defended himself against charges of grandstanding.
The reason I am strident in my criticism of the President of the United States is because by invading Iraq, something I was not asked about by the commission, but something I chose to write about a lot in the book, by invading Iraq, the President of the United States has greatly undermined the war on terrorism.
President Bush's National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice was also criticized for her decision not to testify at the hearings. What will all of this mean in an election year? Joining us on the line is Juliet Kayyem. She's senior fellow at the International Security Program at the JFK School of Government at Harvard University. And Juliet, to a little bit of the politics first, that statement we just heard from Clark was met with a long, stunned silence.
Absolutely. I mean, it did get ugly yesterday, and I'm not a family member of, you know, people who died in 9/11, and I started to feel a little bit uncomfortable about how personal it got against Clark, and I thought he sort of handled himself well. Clark's basic point is this, and I think a lot of times it's conflated both by the commissioners and the media. There is a difference between an imperfect plan, which I think the Clinton administration can be accused of, right? They weren't aggressive enough. They didn't kill bin Laden when they could. They didn't use military action effectively. And no plan, which is clearly what Clark is saying about the Bush administration. So we can criticize the Clinton administration for an imperfect plan, but what seems to have come out, and no commissioner has denied, is that there appeared to be no plan coming out of the Bush administration. In this regard, another point is important. Clark's testimony got all the media attention and public attention yesterday. I think Sandy Berger's testimony was damning to the Bush administration for this reason. There's two ways to fight terrorism. One is offensively, go out, kill bin Laden, get the Taliban, whatever else. And then clearly there's a defensive action that needs to occur. And Sandy Berger said that when we were leading up to the millennium and you had this spike in intelligence and you knew something could happen, what they did is they met with the president every day for 30 days straight. They, you know, shook the trees. They got people involved. And to be honest, we disrupted two terrorist attacks, one in Boston and one at LAX, before the millennium.
And this is during the Clinton administration.
This is during the Clinton administration. I think one of the things that the Bush administration is going to have to account for after the testimony yesterday is every single Bush administration official said that the spike in intelligence went up in June, July, and August of 2001. And from what we can tell, nothing defensively happened.
And we can't tell more because National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice has said she won't testify while she's doing the talk show circuit.
A number of National Security Advisors have testified before Congress, and certainly in the context of 9/11, you can't imagine sort of a bigger event that a National Security Advisor should testify to. And it just seems like the Bush administration is losing this one because, of course, she comes out yesterday with declassified emails, which that doesn't look right, you know, to declassify an email solely for a press conference. And a number of other, you know, talk shows and other press conferences where she tries to defend herself. And I think the 9/11 families have it right. If she can defend herself in front of NBC and ABC and NPR, she should be able to defend herself under oath before an important commission.
Juliet, there was silent testimony in that room as well. I'm thinking of the families of the victims. What kind of impact are they going to have on all of this?
You know, right now they're really a wild card. I mean, we can just see what they're doing. They're hugging Richard Clark. They applaud after he finishes testifying. And then, of course, when Richard Armitage, number two at the State Department, walks in Condoleezza Rice's place, they walk out. Mm-hmm. Important public and, I have to say, political gestures. The 9/11 families are organized and they're angry. I have heard some Republicans tell me off the record they are nervous now about having the convention in New York because if the 9/11 families organize, they don't know, you know, which way it's going to cut.
Mm-hmm. Juliet, thank you.
Thank you.
Juliet Kayyem is a senior fellow at the International Security Program at the JFK School of Government at Harvard University. Well, Framingham, Massachusetts resident Carrie Lamack's mother died aboard American Airlines Flight 11 on 9/11. Carrie was at yesterday's hearing. She joins us on the line from Washington, D.C. Welcome.
Thank you.
First of all, how have these hearings been for you? You've been there for both days?
I have to say, I think that for most family members, it's been pretty frustrating. We've seen a partisan game being played where safety is being turned into a partisan issue, which it is not. Democrats and Republicans were murdered alike on September 11th.
Well, how did you feel when you heard Richard Clark's apology?
It was really emotional. I think the fact that he's willing to come out and be courageous enough to admit to his failures and to apologize for them should be commended. He asked for our understanding and for our forgiveness, and I think that without having everyone come forward to testify, including the current National Security Advisor, Dr. Rice, we can't have understanding, and I implore her to come forward and speak publicly under oath. And in terms of forgiveness, I don't know how to answer that question. He has gained my respect and gratitude for being strong enough to come forward and say things that clearly are going to draw some criticism to him, but he believes it strongly enough that it's important for the American safety.
But it sounds like it's not about blame for you.
Blaming anybody isn't going to get us anywhere. I think the best thing that we can do to make sure that our loved ones didn't die in vain, that my mother's murder was not in vain, is to make sure that other Americans don't suffer the same loss.
As you well know, Carrie, there are some other victims' relatives who aren't even paying any attention to the hearings. They say there's no blame. This couldn't have been prevented. It doesn't bring my loved one back. They're going in a different direction. Can you understand that?
I think everyone's entitled to their opinion. If I've learned anything in the past 2.5 years, it's that each person grieves individually, and you can't judge that. That being said, for me, it is important to figure out what went wrong. That's not a blame game. That's just saying there's clearly failures, and we've heard multiple people say that it might have been prevented had people done their job. Clark just said that about Dr. Rice. Whether or not that's true, I don't know. I'm not an expert.
Richard Clark said he didn't know either if it could have been prevented, but he did know that certain things weren't done. You know well that some are saying that his apology, his testimony, it's all grandstanding. How did it feel to you sitting in the room? Did it feel genuine?
I think listening to Mr. Clark speak, his apology did feel genuine. That I can say from the bottom of my heart. But we did see some more partisan games being played, and that really saddens me.
Can you give me an example of what you think is partisanship?
Well, watching Secretary Albright testify, she was asked some questions about what she knew ahead of time and didn't, and basically stated, well, we knew this, we didn't know enough, we didn't think that we had public sway to be able to do something about bin Laden. Later on, we heard Secretary Powell testify that they had spent 8 months preparing a terrorist attack plan. He said that they prepared that plan knowing that al-Qaeda terrorists were not in the United States. When one of the commissioners asked him about Richard Clark's testimony saying that, or in his book saying that he had told Secretary Powell long ago, before he even took office, that terrorists were in the United States, Secretary Powell's answer was not yes or no. It was, I wasn't in office then. It was not my problem. Those aren't his exact words.
That's how you received it.
That's what it sounded like.
And finally, it has been a while, but I suppose it's never enough time. I mean, this has got to really bring back that horrible day for you, and it's got to have you thinking about your mom, I would think.
I miss her a lot. I miss her a lot. I think that the pain is still there. The pain is still very acute. This is not a typical grieving process, because it's not typical that your loved one's murder happens to coincide with a national tragedy. For us, it's very personal. For the nation, it's obviously a day that's important to everyone else for different reasons. But for us, it's the day my mother was murdered.
Well, Carrie, thank you so much for spending some time with us. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Robin.
Carrie Lamech of Framingham, Massachusetts. She spoke to us from Washington, D.C. She's founder and secretary of the group Families of September 11th.
After a week of vacation, John Kerry returns to the campaign trail today with a gala Washington shindig to raise more than $10 million for the Democratic Party. President Bush will raise some money of his own tonight in Boston. He's expected to pocket a cool $1 million or so. It's almost 2 years to the day since Bush signed the McCain-Feingold campaign finance reforms into law, and this presidential race is the most expensive in history. Tony Raymond, the co-founder of PoliticalMoneyline.com, joins us now to run some numbers. Welcome, Tony.
Hello, Bill.
Tony, thanks for joining us. What's in the kitty? How much does Bush-Cheney have, and how much does Kerry have?
Well, their last reports, which covered through February 29th, Bush had $110 million of cash on hand, and Kerry had $2.3 million cash on hand.
In the last month or so, Tony, since Kerry became the presumptive nominee, what has each campaign raised since the last FEC filing?
Well, there have been some media reports. Kerry has apparently taken in a little over $18 million this month, and Bush has raised another $10 million.
So is the playing field level at this point? And, of course, we're talking about being able to buy television ads.
Well, yes and no. That's an interesting question. Right now, candidate-to-candidate matchup, no, it's not very level. But there are some outside influences that are bringing in some resources to bear, especially in media buys.
Explain.
Well, these organizations are called 527 groups. They're given that title because of their tax exemption. Especially on the Democratic side, they're groups that have been formed by former party operatives that have decided to raise funds and spend funds. Now, they're limited in the way that they spend the funds. Ostensibly, they're supposed to spend these funds for state and local campaigns. However, their messages, as long as they don't directly advocate the election or defeat of a federal candidate, they can make these messages in critical places. And that's exactly what they're doing.
Yeah, you're talking about groups like MoveOn.org and Media Fund, which back Kerry. Where are they making their media buys?
Well, they're making them in the critical states. Everyone's seen the map of the United States, the blue states and the red states. Well, a lot of the money is being spent now in the Rust Belt. Michigan in particular has seen a big influx of spending. And it's not unusual for folks in those local media markets to see a lot of TV ads talking about the issues and the candidates themselves.
And you're suggesting, I think, that that levels the playing field to a great extent. President Bush has much more money to spend on ads, but these 527 groups are also able to get the Democratic message out, although Kerry has less money.
Well, that's very true. And the 527 groups are doing it in a way that's a bit controversial. There are some groups here in Washington that have decided that they're playing outside the rules of the new campaign finance law that was recently passed. And because of that, they're trying to get the FEC to stop the media buys.
I guess you'd call these 527 groups soft money, right? Money that's not directly contributed to a candidate. Wasn't McCain-Feingold supposed to get rid of soft money?
Yes and no. It was supposed to prevent soft money going to the national party committees. But it never was intended to stop soft money being spent for state and local elections. The question here is how this money is being spent. Senator Feingold is actually on the record saying that these groups, if they're intending on influencing the presidential election, then they should actually be registering with the FEC as hard dollar committees.
Where do you think this is going to go? I imagine it's primarily Republicans criticizing the 527s.
Well, it is. There's a couple of things that are going on. The FEC has to make a ruling soon about the role of these 527 committees in the election. But some of those members are already on record as saying that they don't want to rock the boat right now so far into the election cycle. So not too much might happen immediately. On the other hand, the Republicans, I'm sure, are studying the situation and may be compelled to create their own 527 organizations and start to compete in the raising of soft dollars.
Tony Raymonds, co-founder of PoliticalMoneyline.com. Tony, thanks a lot.
You bet, Bill.
Just ahead, the effects of the war in Iraq on Libya and Syria.
And later in the show was the quintessential blues man, Robert Johnson, just a pop star in his day.
There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's here and now.
When Libya renounced weapons of mass destruction last year, presumably the world became a safer place. The Bush administration credited the war in Iraq, suggesting Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi feared military action against his regime. Some, though, question that war's impact on Gaddafi, as well as the extent of Libya's WMD program. A private arms control group said yesterday in Washington that though Gaddafi certainly had nuclear ambitions, he was far from fulfilling them. Flint Leverett is a scholar at the Brookings Institution who worked at the National Security Council for the Bush administration. Welcome, Mr. Leverett.
Good morning.
Mr. Leverett, how much did the invasion of Iraq have to do with Libya renouncing its weapons of mass destruction?
I wouldn't say absolutely that the invasion of Iraq had nothing to do with Libya's decision, but the fact is that Libya had been engaged in a diplomatic process with the United States and the United Kingdom for years, not just going back before the Iraq War, but also going back before September 11 and before this administration even took office.
And why were they doing that?
I think that Libya made a strategic decision at some point in the mid or late 1990s that it wanted to seek a better relationship with the West, the United States in particular. And on that basis, they started a secret diplomatic channel process with the Clinton administration. And then when the Bush administration came to power, we basically picked up on that diplomatic process, made it clear to the Libyans that no improvement in relations was possible until they dealt with the Lockerbie issue. But we also made it clear to the Libyans that if they wanted to improve their bilateral relationship with the United States and get out from under U.S. sanctions, that they were going to have to address our concerns on WMD. I believe it's more in that context that the Libyans made a decision that they really needed to come clean on WMD, and you know, we've seen the outcome that we all welcome.
So that was a carrot and stick approach, wasn't it? Some have criticized the Bush administration for mostly wielding a big stick.
Yes, and frankly, as someone who worked in the administration, I would think in many cases that criticism is unfortunately justified. But in the Libya case, we did something which the administration hasn't been willing to do with other problem states like Iran or Syria, and that is to say up front, okay, we are not going to improve relations with you until you address our concerns, but if you address those concerns in a way we consider satisfactory, here is what's in it for you.
Flint Leverett, a scholar at the Brookings Institution. Mr. Leverett, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Another country the war in Iraq was supposed to rattle in the direction of change is Syria. In recent weeks, unrest has spread across the country's north among Kurds, who seem inspired by the Kurds in Iraq. There are reports of major clashes between Kurds and Syrian police, with Kurds reporting as many as 100 killed. So are winds of change blowing in authoritarian Syria, too? We're joined now by Reem Alaf. She's an associate fellow at the Royal Institute of International Affairs in London. She's herself Syrian. Welcome, Ms. Alaf.
Thank you.
Reem, this recent unrest began at a soccer game in a town near the border with Iraq with a large Kurdish population, a town called Qamishli, and then it quickly spread even to the capital, Damascus, right?
Well, apparently, Damascus and Aleppo, from what I've heard, which both have sizable Kurdish communities, there were some demonstrations, especially in a suburb of Damascus, but I think that was handled and controlled very quickly. Several arrests were made by the Syrian authorities. I think that things got a bit worse in Aleppo, where I hear that some government offices were trashed and some things were burned. The worst was in Qamishli, and things seem to have quieted down at the moment. We still don't know how many people, how many Kurds indeed, are in jail at the moment. What I know is that the Syrian authorities tried to handle the situation very openly, and it was a big item on the media every day for several days. So this is a new phenomenon, by the way, in Syria. Usually the Syrian regime just ignores any unrest that can happen in Syria. This time they went all the way out and they said, look, we are one nation, we are all citizens of Syria, and please everybody calm down, we're all in this together.
Yeah.
Funnily enough, a lot of people have been saying that the Americans had a hand in the unrest that happened. I think that the Americans would be shooting themselves in the foot at this point in time if they indeed encouraged the Kurdish unrest, because encouraging unrest in any Kurdish area, whether it's in Syria or Turkey or Iran, would not help the stability of Iraq.
Well, whether the Americans had anything to do with the unrest, what about the larger question and prime motivation for the war in Iraq of bringing democracy to places like Syria?
Unfortunately, a lot of the Arab governments around Iraq are using the quagmire, what they see as being a quagmire in Iraq, to prove to their people that, look, this is not the democracy that you need. We're going to give you a homegrown democracy. As you know, the Bush administration was planning to unveil the Greater Middle East Initiative in June, I believe, in the G8 summit. Apparently, these plans have been shelved because some of the Arab leaders, Mubarak included, have argued with the U.S. that we need to be seen with our people, that we're the ones leading this reform. So give us a chance. So a lot of people think that in the upcoming Arab summit in Tunisia on the 29th of March, the Arab governments are going to make some kind of declaration, some kind of plan to further democracy. obviously, most of the Arab countries, most of the civil societies will tell you this is not enough, because there are no different kinds of democracies. The democracy that works in the U.S. can work perfectly well in Syria and in Egypt and indeed in Saudi Arabia. So the people are not really buying that. But unfortunately, what's happening is that the people also don't appreciate being pressured by the U.S. or by Britain. And they feel that their dignity is being tampered with. So on the one hand, you've got people who want to push the government further for reforms. On the other, the government comes and tells them, look, you know, they're hitting at us and they're pressuring us. You don't want that. We want to do this ourselves. So they have to be pushed gently, but we're only seeing a stick policy. We need to see some carrots along with the sticks.
Rima Laff is an associate fellow at the Royal Institute of International Affairs in London. Rima Laff, thanks very much.
My pleasure, Bill.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
It's being reported that a U.S. soldier died in a bomb blast outside of Baghdad today. This latest death comes amid warnings from U.S. and Iraqi officials that attacks will likely increase as the date for the transfer of power from the Coalition Provisional Authority to Iraqis draws near. A governing body made up of Iraqis is scheduled to assume control on June 30th. WBUR's Michael Goldfarb is in Baghdad. He joins us on the line. Hello, Michael.
Hello, Robin.
This handover is scheduled for just less than 100 days now. Yesterday, Paul Bremer, top administrator in Iraq, said the country's on the way to full democracy. From your vantage point, is it?
If you define full democracy as people going about their daily lives, free to select their leaders, and live in a secure society, then I think giant steps are still required. Mm-hmm. The security here is still very, very poor. In terms of their abilities to do what they want and say what they want, well, yes, they certainly have that, and people are going about their business during the daylight hours, at least.
Yeah. We hear that insurgents have been increasingly targeting Iraqi police, speaking of security, more than 300 killed in the past year. They are presumably getting paid by Paul Bremer's office. When power is handed over, who will pay these policemen? Where's that money going to come from, and who will, you know, ensure their safety?
Well, let's start with the first question, which is nobody knows. If you go around the Iraqi Governing Council, the group appointed by the United States as a transitional body towards a democratically elected assembly here, this is the question on everybody's mind. Who's going to sign the checks on June 30th? This hasn't been decided. How will they continue to recruit police? I took a photo of a kind of of a recruitment poster. It was a handsome Iraqi police officer, and the copy on this big billboard was something along the lines of, I risked my life today to help build a new democratic Iraq. Huh. What did you do for your country?
Huh.
I took a picture of that on Monday. Today I went back to the same billboard, and it had been completely painted over in black.
Huh.
And it's a billboard that's situated on a traffic island, a good 30 feet above the traffic. So it took somebody quite some effort, and no one stopped him as he painted out the Iraqi policemen on that ad. this is the attitude of people, at least amongst those who are, I guess, characterized as resistance. There's a sense here that if you work for the United States, you are in some way collaborating against the Iraqi people. And it is a very dangerous position.
Are there any, you know, bright lights emerging? Is someone emerging as an Iraqi leader?
No. At this moment, in the streets of Iraq, the level of resentment cutting across all classes of society against the U.S. is profound. If anyone had in mind to put himself forward politically, they would be foolish to do it at this point. Mm-hmm. And then there's the further point, Robin. Here we are talking about elections. No one has the faintest idea yet what the electoral system will be, what the Constitution will be. So all these things need to be settled. The new international interaction with Iraq needs to be settled through the UN Security Council. And when all of that is in place, then I think you may begin to see politicians emerging. But until all of those conditions happen, no one is going to put his head above the parapet and try and assert himself into what is still just a notional political process.
Michael Goldfarb, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
WBUR's Michael Goldfarb speaking to us from Baghdad.
Two million people will die from it this year. Tuberculosis, a disease some say gets way too little attention. Scientists are now worried about an increase in drug-resistant strains of the disease. Some 300,000 people develop drug-resistant cases of tuberculosis every year. Dr. Lee Reichman is director of the National Tuberculosis Center in New Jersey and author of the book, Time Bomb. He joins us on the line from New Delhi, India. Welcome, doctor.
Thank you very much, Bill.
Dr. Reichman, how serious a problem is tuberculosis in the world today?
Well, tuberculosis is not recognized as such by the public, but it's the biggest single killer of any infectious disease, kills 2 million people a year, and it's cheaply preventable and curable.
Preventable and curable, why is it still killing people?
Because of neglect, because of the fact that people think it's a done deal, it's not a problem, or the perception in developed countries is it's a disease of foreigners or a disease of poor people and minority groups, so they're not interested in doing something about it.
Now, of great concern are these new so-called super strains of TB. Tell us about that.
Well, tuberculosis, if you treat it properly, it's easily and cheaply cured in 6 months. If it's not treated properly or patients don't take their medicine properly, then the organisms become resistant. And if they become resistant to two drugs, they're multiple drug resistant. Four drugs, they're super drug resistant. And these are virtually incurable cases.
You wrote, anti-TB drugs must be restricted. Now, what do you mean by that?
If anybody treats patients with TB without making sure they take the medicine properly, then the patient becomes drug resistant.
Yeah.
And these 300,000 multi-drug resistant cases are entirely in people who were not treated properly or didn't take their drugs properly. Multiple drug resistant tuberculosis does not occur in nature. It's man-made.
Is this a problem restricted to the developing world and the poorest countries on earth? What about Europe? What about the United States?
Absolutely not. You can fly from anywhere in the world to anywhere else in the world in 20 to 24 hours. The main risk factor for transmission of tuberculosis is breathing. So someone who comes from former Soviet Union, where they have a lot of multiple drug-resistant tuberculosis, who is infected with active multiple drug-resistant tuberculosis, is going to share the air on the airplane or when he gets to the United States and can spread the disease. We have a patient in our clinic we're taking care of who has multiple drug-resistant tuberculosis, which she picked up when she was a nurse in Russia.
What would you like to see the government of our country do about it?
Well, I'd like to see the government of our country recognize that tuberculosis needs as much attention, if not more, than AIDS, because tuberculosis kills more AIDS patients than any other infection. You know, AIDS doesn't kill anybody. It's the infections you get along with AIDS. And tuberculosis is the biggest killer of AIDS patients worldwide. The government says, oh, put all this money in AIDS, but they don't realize if you prevent tuberculosis, you can prolong the life of AIDS patients on the average of 2 to 6 years.
Doctor, as a doctor, as someone who heals people, what's it like to see a disease that can be prevented, not prevented?
It's extraordinarily frustrating. I see what the government does with things like bioterrorism, and they put hundreds of million dollars into bioterrorism, which we look at anthrax, perhaps bioterrorism, killed five people, smallpox killed none. But something like tuberculosis, which is a global health threat, has money cut, and the Centers for Disease Control has actually cut money for tuberculosis control in the current fiscal year.
Dr. Lee Reichman is director of the National Tuberculosis Center in New Jersey. He joined us from New Delhi, India. Dr. Reichman, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Bill.
You're listening to Here and Now.
It's time to open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts.
After our conversation about whether or not the U.S. is safer following the war in Iraq, Paul Simons, who listens to Here and Now on WHYY in Philadelphia, voiced his strong opinion. He writes, "How do we stop the next September 11th? My suggestion, just as with the Soviet Union for 50 years, mutually assured destruction. If they bomb one of our cities, we bomb one of theirs, massively. What city? We know who's behind the financing and fomenting of this stuff. Blow one of their holy cities to shreds if they bomb us. Maybe next time they'll think twice."
Well, during a discussion about presidential politics, we said Democratic candidate John Kerry was claiming that foreign leaders backed him more than they backed President Bush. That sent Robin Watson of Provincetown, Massachusetts, to her computer. She emails, "The Boston Globe reporter who originally used this phrase has since clearly stated that this was a mistranscription from his notes. Please issue a correction." Well, according to reporter Patrick Healy, Kerry, in an offhand response to someone else's remark about foreign animosity toward Bush, said this, "I've been hearing it, I tell you, the coverage in other countries. I've met more leaders who can't go out and say it publicly, but boy, they look at me and say, you got to win this. You got to beat this guy."
Our story about a new warning from the Food and Drug Administration that patients taking certain antidepressant medication be observed for suicidal behavior prompted Doreen Grasso of Providence, Rhode Island, to call our listener line. She'd been prescribed antidepressants, but not for depression. We wanted to find out more, so we called her.
I was taking antidepressants through a dermatologist's recommendation to clear up my skin and dermatitis.
Right. Have you talked to any doctors about it?
Yes, I have, actually. When I questioned another dermatologist about it, they said it was a common practice. And when they decided to increase the dose, I talked to a therapist who recommended that I not do it.
So there was concern that you shouldn't be on it and it might have side effects for you.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, Doreen, what do you want people to know?
Well, I would like people to know that antidepressants are used for something other than for depression, that they're actually used dermatologically, and I was concerned about who was monitoring these effects on the dermatology patients.
Apparently you are monitoring them, and of course another lesson is to always get more than one doctor's opinion. Well, so what decision have you made finally about whether or not to take them?
Well, I've decided not to take them, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that the dermatologist saw me as a compliant patient because of that, but that's their problem.
Did you actually feel the effects of the antidepressant as well as perhaps any effects for your skin?
There were some slight effects for my skin, but I had a very flat affect while taking the antidepressant, and I didn't like that part of losing that part of my personality.
Well, Doreen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And listener Kenner Rawdon wanted to know the music that was used at the end of an interview we did with the executive director of Godless Americans Political Action Committee, a political group of atheists. It was John Lennon's God off the CD Plastic Ono Band.
God is a concept by which we measure our pain. Yes, we do.
As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or give us a call and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and the town where you live.
Stay with us.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Before Muddy Waters, way before Eric Clapton and the Rolling Stones, there was Robert Johnson.
And I feel so lonesome. You hear me when I'm on.
That's Robert Johnson's Terraplane Blues from 1936. The bluesman's legend blossomed in Great Britain during the 1960s with devilish tales of booze and hard times. But what was fact and what was fiction? Music journalist Elijah Wald writes about the man, the myth, and the music in the new book, Escaping the Delta, Robert Johnson and the Invention of the Blues. And Elijah joins us in the studio. Hello.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
It's also good to talk to you, but you start with almost a sacrilege. You start by saying there's probably been more romantic foolishness written about blues and Robert Johnson in particular than any other genre or performer in the 20th century. Say what?
Yeah, I guess I'm saying he should be a slightly different legend. I mean, as long as we talk about Robert Johnson as the roots of the Rolling Stones and Eric Clapton, that's completely true. Mm-hmm. They fell in love with his work, and he was very influential on them. But people often talk about Robert Johnson as the most important or the most influential blues artist of the 1930s, and that's just ridiculous. Yeah. He was almost unknown in the 1930s, and if we want to talk about black American music, he had almost no effect on black music. His effect really starts with the rock and rollers discovering him in the 60s.
And what an influence he had. In fact, what did Eric Clapton say about Robert Johnson?
Well, the great quote from Eric Clapton is, "There for a few years there, if you didn't know about Robert Johnson, I wouldn't even talk to you."
I went down to the crossroads, fell out.
I want to hear more about that, but first let's hear a little more from Robert Johnson. He first entered a studio on Monday, November 23rd, 1936, but who's counting? And he recorded some tracks. Let's listen to a little.
You better come on in my kitchen. There's hard to be raining out.
Come On in My Kitchen by Robert Johnson, recorded in 1936. Well, Elijah, who influenced Robert Johnson?
Well, there's a list of people, and I actually put out a CD to go with the book. It's called Back to the Crossroads, The Roots of Robert Johnson. But the thing about Robert Johnson is he's the first important blues artist who learned more off records than from the people around him. He's really a creation of the pop world of his day. Mm. So he was learning from the big stars, people like Leroy Carr, Petey Wheatstraw, Kokomo Arnold, Tampa Red.
And in fact, let's listen to a little of one of those artists. You mentioned the CD. It's called Back to the Crossroads, The Roots of Robert Johnson. Some of the songs that influenced him, some that he, as you said, imitated off other records. Let's listen to two. First, the song Little Queen of Spades by Robert Johnson.
I see you're the little queen of spades, and the men will not let her be.
All right, now let's listen to King of Spades by Petey Wheatstraw, also known as the Devil's Son-in-Law. And what are we listening for here?
Well, there are two things. Johnson's song was a strict answer song to this, but also Petey Wheatstraw had a mannerism. He had this thing, whoo, well, that he does on every single record he made and that Robert Johnson imitates perfectly.
So it's sort of a call and response between the two songs?
If we want to talk folklore, it's call and response, but if we want to talk pop culture, he heard a hit and he wrote an answer song to it.
Yeah. Let's listen, Petey Wheatstraw.
I am the king of spades, and the women takes on over me. And now when I lay my racket, woo, my bell, I'm sweet as I can be.
Let's compare them again, Petey Wheatstraw.
But I've been waiting for you, little mama. Woo, my pal, baby, if you ain't got a dime.
And Robert Johnson.
Well, a man don't need a woman. Too fair brown that he got to give all his money to.
By the way, was Robert Johnson imitating Petey Wheatstraw in more ways than one? I mentioned Petey was known as the devil's son-in-law. Let's just mention the devil for a moment here. Because Robert Johnson was supposed to have sold his soul to the devil.
Yeah, well, that's really a myth that started in the 1960s. And again, it's a white myth. If you ask people, there's a wonderful interview with one of Robert Johnson's school friends where a guy says, so did he ever talk about selling his soul to the devil? The guy says, oh, yeah, he was always joking around like that. We never did take him serious. You know, he was a Petey Wheatstraw nut and that sort of stuff, just like now. You know, being a gangster, being a dangerous character.
And the day keeps on burning me. The hellhound on my trail. Hellhound on my trail. Hellhound on my trail.
But why was it? I mean, again, it goes back to how the white fans who embraced him in the 60s and 70s and beyond sort of created a new mythological character in Robert Johnson. Why was it? Why was that so important to people like Eric Clapton and the Rolling Stones?
Well, you know, everybody has their dreams. And the black dream when Johnson was growing up, and they put it on Robert Johnson, was, you know, you learn some of the, you learn to be a great guitarist, you learn to sound like the big stars in Chicago, and you can wear a suit and drive a Cadillac and move the hell out of the Delta. Whereas the myth in 1960s was the danger of rock and roll, James Dean, Marlon Brando, die young, leave a good-looking corpse.
Right.
So, you know, each group had its myth, and both groups put that myth on Robert Johnson.
Right. How did he die?
The story, there are various stories, but the most likely one is that he was poisoned by a jealous husband. A guy who he was working for put some poison in his whiskey.
And, you know, is there a chance that he just had some bad fish? I mean, you know, going along with the...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's, you know, he certainly fooled around with a lot of women, but we know very little about... I mean, his death certificate said syphilis. I see no reason to think there was any evidence for that except a plantation manager saying, oh, he's a musician. He probably just died of syphilis.
Yeah. Well, it's hard to tell, it's hard to tell. When all your love's in vain. All my love's in vain.
So, Elijah, what are you saying? Were blues artists way back in the day, you know, really happy-go-lucky guys, and for some reason white musicians, modern white musicians, have wanted to keep them in a certain stereotype?
It wasn't so much happy-go-lucky or not. It was that they were pop musicians. You know, first of all, Bessie Smith, Ma Rainey, then people like Leroy Carr, Tampa Red. But Robert Johnson also in his dreams, in his aspirations, were people who were, they were hip, current musicians. They were following the latest trends. They were following the latest hits. And they were in the most popular style of their day. And we've reinvented them as sort of these monsters from the mythical Delta. And they just weren't that.
Right. If they lived today, if they were producing their music today, they might want to use a synthesizer or sample music or do anything they could to be more contemporary.
Personally, I think there's very little question that if someone like Robert Johnson were around today, he'd be doing rap. It's just the obvious thing for someone with his, you know, someone with the taste of trying to be sort of a dangerous hip musician, black musician, you're doing rap now.
Yeah.
From Memphis to Norfolk, it's a 36-hour drive. Amen, it's like a prisoner, and he's never satisfied.
It's funny, it's almost another form of subjugation that the white artist wants to keep the mythical black artist in this sort of organic, on the porch, in the rocker form in their mind's eye.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah. Someone like Robert Johnson, all, you know, already in his day, all we have recorded is him doing blues, but he sang Gene Autry hits, he sang Bing Crosby, he sang all the pop music of his time.
He loved them.
Well, he was a pop musician.
Yeah.
I went to the crossroads.
Elijah, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Elijah Wald, author of the book Escaping the Delta, Robert Johnson and the Invention of the Blues, and producer of the companion CD, Back to the Crossroads, The Roots of Robert Johnson. For more information, check out our website, here-now.org.
At the Lord above, I'm mercy now. Say, poor Bob, if you please. East at the crossroads, flag to flag arise.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR in Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
I'll drop the flag around. Did nobody seem to know me, baby? Everybody passed me by.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.